Welcome. I'm Eric Fleming, host of A Moment with Eric Fleming, the podcast of our time. I want to personally thank you for listening to the podcast. If you like what you're hearing, then I need you to do a few things. First, I need subscribers. I'm on Patreon at patreon.com/A Moment with Eric Fleming. Your subscription allows an independent podcaster like me the freedom to speak truth to power and to expand and improve the show. Second, leave a 5-star review for the podcast on the streaming service you listen to it. That will help the podcast tremendously. Third, go to the website, momenteric.com. There you can subscribe to the podcast, leave reviews and comments, listen to past episodes, and even learn a little bit about your host. Lastly, don't keep this a secret like it's your own personal guilty pleasure. Tell someone else about the podcast. Encourage others to listen to the podcast and share the podcast on your social media platforms, because it is time to make this moment a movement. Thanks in advance for supporting the podcast of our time. I hope you enjoy this episode as well. Hello, and welcome to another Moment with Eric Fleming. I am your host, Eric Fleming. And today is one of those days I'm excited. You know why? Because I have a guest. And this is going to be an interesting topic, and it's going to be kind of deep how we get into it a little bit. I believe, just based on the questions that I was sitting here trying to figure out to ask this guest, right? I think this is going to be an intense discussion. And the brief time that we are going to have is probably not going to be enough, but I think this will be worth your attention and worth further conversation down the road. So, but before we get to our guest, it's time for Grace G and a moment of news.
Thanks, Eric. Republicans, after several candidates and 4 floor votes, elected Mike Johnson of Louisiana as the 56th Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. The U.S. government posted a $1.695 trillion budget deficit in fiscal 2023, the largest since a COVID-fueled $2.78 trillion budget gap in 2021, due to decreased revenues, increased outlays, and interest on the federal debt. Former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows was granted immunity to testify in the Department of Justice's 2020 election interference case. Meanwhile, a U.S. judge temporarily lifted a partial gag order on Donald Trump's public statements about the federal criminal case. In Georgia, 3 of Trump's former lawyers pled guilty to illegal efforts to reverse his 2020 election defeat in the state. At Donald Trump's civil fraud trial, Trump was fined a total of $15,000 for violations of a gag order, and his former lawyer Michael Cohen testified that Trump inflated the value of his real estate assets to secure favorable insurance premiums. 2 American hostages and 2 Israeli hostages were released by Hamas and reunited with their respective families in Israel. A Detroit, Michigan synagogue president, Samantha Wall, was found stabbed to death, with officials stating the crime does not appear to be motivated by anti-Semitism. U.S. Senator Bob Menendez pled not guilty to charges of acting as an unregistered foreign agent for the Egyptian government. The U.S. Supreme Court declined to intervene in a dispute over Louisiana's congressional district map. President Biden's name will not appear on the New Hampshire Democratic primary ballot following the state's refusal to follow new Democratic Party rules. And Richard Roundtree, the actor who played John Shaft in the Shaft films, died at 81 from pancreatic cancer. I am Grace G, and this has been A Moment of News.
All right. Thank you, Grace. And as always, you know, because this is a recorded show, there are some things that have, developed since we put together the news thing. So either I'll try to hit it on Patreon or try to hit it on the regular podcast. So when we get into the second half, there's a couple of developments I want to hit that happened after we pre-recorded the news segment. But let me get to my guest, right? So a lot of people in the world that I've circulated with, I served on the Judiciary B Committee and the Juvenile Justice Committees when I was in the House of Representatives in Mississippi. So one of the issues that always comes up in criminal justice is dealing with bail. And there's a proposal that is kicked in California for zero bail in Los Angeles County primarily. And it got some attention because 12 of the cities, there's like 88 cities in Los Angeles County, 12 of those cities, primarily in the southern part. And if you know anything about Los Angeles County, which I don't know a whole lot, but I do know that the majority of the county is either in the central part of the state, which is basically LA, and then going south, right? It's not a whole lot going on in the northern part of the state, and I think that's geography or whatever. But anyway, there's 12 cities in Los Angeles County that have said, yeah, we don't want to be a part of the zero bail thing. So I have a guy on that may can address at least one side of the issue, if not cover both sides, but at least address one side of the issue. And his name is Jeffrey J. Clayton. Mr. Clayton is the executive director of the American Bail Coalition. He has worked as a public policy and government relations professional and also as a licensed attorney, serving a variety of clients in legal, legislative, and policy matters. Mr. Clayton also worked in government science, representing the Colorado Judicial Branch and State Labor Department and the U.S. Department of Transportation. He is also a prior Presidential Management Fellow and finalist for the U.S. Supreme Court Fellows Program. Mr. Clayton holds a BBA from Baylor University, an MS in Public Policy from the University of Rochester, New York, and a JD from the Sturm College of Law at the University of Denver. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my distinct honor and privilege to have as a guest on this podcast, Mr. Jeffrey J. Clayton. All right, Jeff Clayton, how you doing, sir? You doing good?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing lovely, man. Glad that you are able to come on. I want to do something different with you. Normally, I try to get one quote that either relates to what the person is doing, what they might have said. But I've got two for you. So the first one, I think you said this. For richer or poor, recidivist criminals dwell at the center of our criminal justice problems. Rather than helping them maintain the status quo they currently enjoy, if we are ever to get a handle on the problem, we must do everything we can to prevent them from continuing to victimize our communities. Kind of expand on that quote for me.
Well, I think it starts with a simple fact that the U.S. Department of Justice statistics and other statistics and other towns have found that anywhere from 60 to 80% of violent crime is committed by roughly 5% of criminal defendants who do these crimes over and over and over again. And so when you want to talk about a crime problem, when you want to talk about issues of crime, that's the population that's causing the most of the damage. And so that's two sides of the coin, because it also suggests that people on the low end of the system, the one and two timers, aren't the real problem, and that's not the people that we need to attack. In other words, there is a need for reform on maybe the low end, largely because we need to focus the criminal justice system on these people that continue to slip through the cracks. And unfortunately, some of these bail policies are exactly that. It's allowing this group of who we consider to be repeat violent defendants to take advantage of bail statutes that allow them to slip through the cracks when the people we want to help, who are presumed innocent, who are first time offenders, are helped. But unfortunately, we're helping, this particular group of people as well.
Okay. Now, the other quote, before I get into that, the American Bail Coalition, who you represent, is a trade organization made up of national bail insurance companies who are responsible for underwriting criminal bail bonds throughout the United States of America. That's a true statement, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. Now, here's the quote. The quote says, the commercial bail industry actively defends cash bail systems that produce racially and economically unjust outcomes. High rates of pretrial incarceration, significant costs to taxpayers, and negative public consequences. The commercial bail industry traps people who cannot afford cash bail premiums in a predatory cycle of debt and incarceration in the same way that payday loan companies and other predatory lenders make a profit by taking advantage of people who need help affording the necessities of daily life. What's your response to that quote?
Well, there's a lot going on there, but let me start by saying I defend the constitutional right to bail. The constitutional right to bail preexisted all of this era of mass incarceration. In fact, eliminating the right to bail in the federal system, the right to quote unquote cash bail, has resulted in, a massive increase in mass incarceration. Expanding the use of dangerousness predictions and incorporating that into bail has led to mass incarceration. Now, to the idea that we're payday lenders, I don't think so. I think we're the reason that people don't have to use payday lenders because our bail agents are not allowed to charge interest. I don't think that we're predatory. I think we allow bail agents in those communities to serve as bail agents without having to own significant amounts of property. In other words, under the old bail system, it was go find a rich guy to act as your personal surety. Now, people in the community with insurance underwriting can level the playing field and act as personal sureties. So now, to the idea that the entire criminal justice system has racial disparities and all that sort of thing, of course it does. I think the statistics establish that. I think we know that's true. But I don't think bail is part and parcel of that. I think bail is the one area where the community can fight back against the state and say, no, we're bailing him out and you're not prosecuting him and you're not holding him in jail. And we're going to not allow the state to do that. So I'd be careful incorporating bail into the rest of the system with things like sentencing and stuff like that, because I think it's different. And I think it does allow the community to fight back against the criminal justice system. And history has certainly proven that when there was cash bail in the federal system, there was a 24% incarceration rate. Now there's a 75% rate, some 40 years later when we haven't had bail.
Okay. So that leads to the issue that we're here to talk about, which is this zero bail system that has been implemented in California. And it got implemented, the start date was October 1st. Am I correct on that?
That's right. And that's in Los Angeles County.
Okay. So I'm going to read this. This is what I gathered. Now, the zero bail system, officially dubbed the Los Angeles Superior Court as Pre-Arrangement Release Protocols, or PARP, largely eliminates the existing cash bail system for all but the most serious of crimes. Most people arrested on suspicion on nonviolent or non-serious offenses will either be cited and released in the field or booked and released at a police or sheriff's station with orders to appear in court on a specific date for arraignment once they are actually charged with a crime. Arrestees who are believed to present a heightened threat to the public or be a flight risk will be referred to a magistrate judge who will review the case and determine whether the person shall be held in custody pending arraignment or released under non-financial restrictions, such as electronic monitoring. Once a person is charged and appears in court for arraignment, a judge could change or revoke the defendant's conditions. Now, that's, an interpretation of it. Now, in reading this, the mayor of Glendora, who is representing one of the 12 cities that's filing a legal case or injunction, I guess, to stop this from going into effect. Am I correct on that?
That's right. They are.
Okay. And are you, is your organization assisting them in that lawsuit?
No, but I think I can talk about why I think it's important, but we would support that sort of in the abstract without, getting into the court case.
I got you. Okay. Yeah, I think that's important for listeners to know, because sometimes, whether you're doing an amicus curiae brief or whatever, they need to know the involvement. So you're basically supporting the lawsuit, but you're not actively engaged in the lawsuit.
That's right.
Okay. All right. So the mayor of Glendora said that the bail schedule will result in a significant increase in criminals released back into the community after their arrest. It says, under the new policy, individuals charged with felonies, including automobile theft, organized retail theft, and hit and runs with personal injury, are now eligible for book and release. Other charges that now qualify for zero bail, including some DUIs, reckless driving with bodily injury, and misdemeanor level assaults. Okay, so let me ask, I can ask the question based off of that. Would you say that this movement now is a response to the 2021 California Supreme Court ruling that stated people cannot be detained simply because they cannot afford to pay cash bail?
It is and it isn't. It is in part. And I think really what's going on in Los Angeles is you have two lawsuits. So you have the city of Glendale and the other cities suing to say you can't do this or you shouldn't do this zero bail. And then you have an activist group called the Civil Rights Corps suing the judges saying you have to do this bail schedule. So the judges are in this pickle where the cities don't want them to. And the activists in suing and the attorney general is not defending California state law to say that the bail schedule is unconstitutional, which a judge held. So this judge is in the middle trying to determine what's going on. And what they did is they just took the pandemic schedule and took these crimes and threw them off the schedule and said, these people are going to get out for free. Is that going to increase crime? It could, because some people are going to slip through the cracks. The reality is this is a small level of crimes in Los Angeles County. Almost all misdemeanors get out for free anyway right now. And also this is pre-arraignment, as you noted in the opening comments, which means before they see a judge, it's automatic. Once they see a judge, the judge can jack up the bails, do whatever they want with the bails. And so we're talking about a limited number of cases and a limited number of circumstances. And maybe that's 5 to 10% of cases. Maybe some percentage of that's going to slip through the cracks and people are going to be re-victimized. So I wouldn't say it's an elimination of money bail. It's being overstated by the activist groups as to what it is. Is it going to cause enough problems to cause these cities and people getting repeat retail theft and having their cars broken into and maybe a few extra DUI drivers driving around? I think it will. And I think that's what the fights are ultimately going to be over, is whether that should be automatic or whether they should have to post bail until they see a judge, and whether the judge should relieve them of the burden of having to post bail and give them a PR bond. In other words, should we have judges look at this or should we have it be automatic? I think that's what will ultimately it will come down to.
Okay. So the 12 cities were citing a study done in Yolo County, which is, I think, Davis, California. It's close right to Sacramento, where it
absolutely
is. So that study said that there was 71% of the people who were arrested were repeat offenders, right? Well, let me look at that. Let me make sure I read that right. It said, showed that 71% of the individuals who were arrested were rearrested during the period from April 2020 through June 1st, 2021, when zero bail policies were in effect. It also revealed that 29% of those who were rearrested were arrested for violent crimes. Now, that's what those 12 cities presented as their argument, why they're against it. But now, the Judicial Council of California, which is, I guess, the policymaking body for the courts in the state, is that an accurate description of them?
Yeah, and the administrative overseeing of the entire court system in California.
Okay. They released this report finding that a risk-based, zero-based zero bail system actually led to increased public safety, with a 5.8% drop in people being rearrested for misdemeanors and a 2.4% decrease in people being rearrested for felonies. So maybe in Davis, California, a lot of the people that are getting arrested are coming back. But according to the Judicial Council of California, they're saying statewide it's actually been a decrease. What is your organization's viewpoint on recidivism as far as what you're seeing with zero bail policies that have been implemented so far?
Well, I'll just respond to that Los Angeles study that you're talking about. I think the jury's out in Los Angeles County. I don't think we know. I think, you know, one, using rearrest is not a good proxy for new crimes. You know, that just means you got picked up for something. That doesn't mean you committed a new crime within what time period. So I don't think we know. I don't, you know, I think that Yolo study, maybe that shows something in Yolo County. But like you said, in Los Angeles County, do we know that zero bail has substantially increased recidivism, or is this happening at kind of a smaller level than maybe we thought? And I think the answer is we don't know. I don't think the pandemic is a good example, because I don't think policing was in full force during that time period. And I think that that's, you know, I think we can dismiss that data that the Judicial Council presents as we don't know. It's not that it decreased recidivism or it's increased. I think the jury, like I said, is out in Los Angeles. You know, states and jurisdictions, we've seen that when you restrict judicial discretion to set bail, that it does increase recidivism. Primarily, we saw that in New York. We've seen that in other jurisdictions. And really what it is repeat defendants getting a zero bail and judges not being able to do a bail on those. And some states like New York, over time, over three different iterations of reforming their bail reform, have built in exceptions for repeat criminality. And like I said, it just comes back to that as we started the show out, which is policies that do allow for exceptions for repeat criminalities will help the bail reform work better. And ones that don't will allow those repeat criminals to continue to shoplift and do all their things that they're doing. And, you know, it doesn't matter what crime you commit. After you've done it 10 times, you know, as a society, we've got to say it's a problem. And that's really what we come down to here, is whether it's possessing guns or doing this or that, you know, whether it's a low level, high level, does it really matter? No, they're repeat scofflaws. And that's really what it comes down to and what criminal justice policies need to target.
So I'm going to ask you this. So I used to be a legislator in Mississippi. So in Mississippi, there's a law that if you are a repeat offender for shoplifting, I can't remember, I want to say it's three times, then you're, the third time it's automatically elevated to a felony. So is a similar situation in California for some of the misdemeanor crimes that if you commit those repeatedly, then it gets elevated to a felony status?
Correct. That's just really just violent crimes, is really in California, and primarily not when it concerns misdemeanors. And I will speak to sort of these three strikes and you're out sentencing and all that kind of policies. The thing to criminal deterrence, it doesn't matter. It has to be, we catch them swiftly and we punish them. And that's it. It doesn't matter if it's 3 years, 2 years, 30 days. You know what I mean? That's what deters crime, is getting ensnared and that the system's swift and it works. And so we don't need three strikes and you're out to have an effective criminal justice system. And I think the New York system pre-bail reform showed that. We can have low incarceration. We enforce the law. Yeah, you get dinged and it's going to happen. It's going to happen over and over. If you do this, the system's going to get back at you. But we don't need to go crazy and give somebody 20 years to do that. It's just, if you do it, you're going to get caught, you're going to get punished. That's what we need to go back to. And that can mean lower sentences and lower incarceration policies. But that's what I'm talking about, is a refocus on recidivists and recidivist criminals as the problem. And unfortunately, we've gotten away from that and said, you know, we're talking about all these other things we need to fix, and we've gotten away from that focus.
So what's the difference between this proposal that's happening now in Los Angeles County and the one that was rejected by California voters in the 2020 California Proposition 25?
Well, the Prop 25 and what was Senate Bill 10 was a complete overhaul of the system. To go to what would have been a risk-based system using a risk assessment computer to put people in categories of, we think these should be detained and these should be released for free. In other words, we would take bail out of the equation and having, you know, me act as your surety or having a bail agent and all, having to secure your release and all that. We would throw that out and just operate a system purely based on detention or release for free. And that's kind of what the federal system did. I'd say what really got them in that system and what the voters really did not like was the risk assessment algorithm. It just, you know, and civil rights groups were opposing that portion of it. And I just think, you know, while people, maybe there was some movement that we wanted to have a system without bail, that we could come up with some other alternate system without bail. That was the linchpin that really destroyed the system, was that these risk computers, really, they use all this historical data. And there were a lot of civil rights groups finding that there were racial biases sort of permanently baked into those. And, you know, I don't know about that. My argument was, I just don't think it was fundamentally a fair a way to decide bail, because it, you know, it based it on future predictions of what somebody's going to do, whereas the American system of justice is based on what you have done. So it just really destroyed the presumption of innocence. But public didn't like it, and that effort went down by double digits from the voters.
And so the difference, so the algorithm was the difference between those, what's currently being presented now, and what the proposition was.
Yeah, and in this Los Angeles County example, like I said, it's really pre-arraignment bail. They're just picking and choosing some things they don't want bail for, versus the wholesale overhauling the system and saying there's going to be no bail for anything. And then we'll tell prosecutors, you want to file for detention or not, and that's it. That's the bail system that we have. And so that would be sort of a more radical version of what's going on here. This is sort of a smaller version of that in a more limited context, based on the crimes that we pick and choose and put in on this bail schedule or not at zero bails.
And that algorithm, was that the issue that the Koch brothers, when they were pushing criminal justice reform, was that the issue they were pushing, the risk-based algorithms?
They certainly were for that. And I think, you know, the Laura and John Arnold Foundation, which is now Arnold Ventures, you know, their algorithm is running the New Jersey system right now. And that was the solution for 5 years. I mean, that really was it. I was at a conference just last week, and one of the attorneys who's been working in bail for a long time said, you know, Jeff, 5 years ago, all we were talking about was the algorithm. All we were talking about was risk assessment was the solution. And now we don't hear that at all. And yet you still have all these municipalities and counties and even whole states sneaking around running the algorithms. And, you know, I would argue that the activist community has let them off the hook. Like, come on, if you didn't like these things, like, you know, you defeated the California referendum, that was good. But guess what? Most of the counties, large counties in California, are still using these things. And a lot of large jurisdictions around the country are still using these things. So, you know, we might want to look into that and not let that issue go away. But certainly that is not a part of the conversation anymore, at least right now.
So is that the difference between California? Because the two I would kind of picked out was California, New Jersey and Alaska, right? And in New Jersey, they make the argument that their pretrial population has decreased by 20%, and there's been a decrease in overall crime. I couldn't get any stats from Alaska. But the assessment piece is what would be different between what is being proposed in Los Angeles County and what is happening in New Jersey.
I think that's right. And I think David Slayton, who's the court administrator in Los Angeles County, who's from Texas and was the court administrator for the state of Texas, is a big proponent of risk assessment algorithms, developed one in Texas, and has said publicly that they're going to start using it now. So I think it will come in, it will play a part. And I think people should be concerned about that, because whether you get out of jail or not in Los Angeles County could hinge on, you know, your age at first arrest, which is what the number one factor in all these algorithms is what age you got arrested at, not what age you got convicted at. So if you were a youthful criminal and you got ensnared, you're the wrong place at the wrong time, that has a permanent effect on you. So, you know, what effect do these algorithms have? You know, people aren't really paying attention anymore, unfortunately.
All right. So I'm gonna throw this scenario at you. Now, I've been in law enforcement in two different states. So this story I'm going to tell is based off experience here. So what about the 80-year-old homeless man arrested for criminal trespass in Atlanta? The bond for that is $2,500, which means that an 80-year-old homeless man has to come up with $250 to get out. He doesn't have it. Then he ends up at the hospital being treated for ailments connected to the fact that he is homeless, at the cost of the taxpayers. And part of that cost is having a deputy like me sitting on him for 8 hours at a time. Wouldn't it be cheaper on the taxpayers if zero bail was in effect for that particular case?
I think so. I mean, we call that the sleeping on the park bench bails. And of course, you know, with the ACLU of Colorado, I passed legislation, you know, 4 or 5 years ago to get at that, to say certain low level municipal offenses, we aren't going to bother. And, you know, if you want to say you're a reformer, it's easy to say, which is we don't have time for this stuff. And that is the truth right now. Law enforcement is so overburdened. We don't have time for this stuff. And it is a mental health issue. And it is, you know, all these homeless populations, like look at my hometown of Denver. Look at what's going on. It's like, yeah, they're finally trying to get these people some help and getting them out of there and saying, hey, you do have to move and you do have to get services and you do have to have a house and all this sort of thing. That's good. But, you know, this has been going on for a long time. And fortunately, I think, you know, maybe things are starting to turn around a little bit.
All right. So I'm going to go over some points, some positions that your organization has taken. And just real quickly, and just ask the question, would zero bail help on that? The American Bail Coalition stands strongly against the expansion of general preventative detention policies. Wouldn't zero bail help that out?
Yeah, I don't think zero bail really plays into that much, except for the fact that what we've seen over time is the more that the system argues for free release, the more there is more crime. And then the more the argument is we need the power of detention. So I think zero bail policies will feed the argument that we need to change the California Constitution to detain people. And I don't think that's good. I think the system of posting bails and non-posting bails is a better system than detention or no detention. And I think history has proven that.
Okay. Because it was saying that the California Committee to Revise the Penal Code studied the issue of eliminating bail schedules and decided to keep them because then judges would have to set bail on every case. And that would delay things to the point where any gains would be lost by everyone waiting in jail for a bail to be set in open court in every case.
Yeah, and the Penal Code Committee got mad at me for capturing the recommendation that way and said, no, we do think we should get rid of them. We just don't know how to get rid of them. And that's what it comes down to. There is no way to get rid of them. The way to get rid of them is to go to the Pennsylvania model, which is really to have judges set bail in all these cases. And in America, that is what should happen. Because if you're facing pretrial incarceration in South Carolina for 2 years, for example, the average time to dispo a felony. So if you're going to sit in jail for 2 years, you should see a judge on that. If you're going to sit in jail for an extra night, you should see a judge on that. And this is America. Your freedom is at stake. That's my position. And so to have these interim solutions like a bail schedule and preset bails and all this, we really don't need it. We need a robust judiciary with attorneys on both sides. Come in. Let's have an argument. Let's get it done and let's move on. And that is, you know, unfortunately, we can't get there. Penal Code Committee recommended we get there, that we have 48-hour reviews of these in California. Legislation was introduced and the Appropriations Committee said we can't afford it. So that's why we're stuck here, which is we don't have enough judges to hear all these and to have individualized consideration in all of them. And if we did, you know, we wouldn't be here. But that's what we should be doing, is just saying, yeah, let's hear the homeless guy. Let's not just put him on a bail schedule and let the chips fall where they may.
Okay. So your organization believes that all criminal defendants who remain in custody should have a right to a second de novo bail hearing if they remain in custody for more than 10 days after arrest. And if there is a change in circumstances warranting additional hearing, would this zero bail policy help fulfill that?
Not really, because you know, there's going to be no pressure to do the hearings at all, really, under this system. We're not going to get there, and that's going to go away. I think the hearings need to happen faster. You know, the de novo hearing gets me in trouble with a lot of judges and legislators because it means you get to do it over again. But again, we're talking about custody. That's the key juncture in a critical case, is whether you stay in jail or not. We all know that. So let's take it seriously. You know, if that's the point in time, then it's conviction, right? Then it's sentencing. Those are the three points in a criminal case. Let's call it what it is. Let's put the time and energy into getting it right.
And then your organization believes all deposits should be returned to the defendant upon conviction, unless a prosecutor makes a showing by a preponderance of the evidence that the keeping of the funds is necessary to serve a legitimate and important state purpose. How would zero bail, would it help or hurt that particular stance?
Well, it would probably just, I don't think it would have much of an impact on that because, you know, people wouldn't be posting bails in those cases. The argument there is that you don't want the court system to use bail as a collections mechanism to say, oh, we're just going to intercept all this bail as a routine basis. The other thing that you don't want is, let's say you're in jail. You don't want me to say, I don't want to post your bail because I'm worried that the state is going to keep it if you plead guilty. You want me to post a bail to say, you have told me and we're going to guarantee that you're going to show up and answer to the charges. You're going to go to all your court hearings. That's what you want me to do. You don't want me thinking about whether you're going to plead guilty and what's going to happen to my money. You want me to know I'm going to get my money back if I put up for you, you go to court. That's what you want. And when you start allowing the state to keep it as a routine basis, you take that whole question of appearance out of the equation, and that's the whole point in the first place.
So in a nutshell, right, what's happening in Los Angeles County is the elected officials there and the judicial system there is trying to figure out a way to decrease the population in the county jail, right? And so their idea is that, well, if we can get officers to, because see in Georgia, and I have to explain this to people, a traffic ticket is a criminal offense in the state of Georgia. So when the officer writes you a ticket, you're under arrest at that point. And when you sign the ticket and say you're going to show up in court, that's your bond to drive home, right?
Right.
So what it sounds like to me is that in Los Angeles, there's going to be certain crimes where the officer basically does that. They give you a field release and let you go, and then you got to show up to court. But there's certain things like, you know, murder, rape, whatever, you know, what we call the more serious, more heinous crimes, they're going to arrest you and put you in jail, and then you got to go through the process. What is the biggest concern you have as an organization dealing with bail? Because the cynics are going to say, and I use that quote, that's why I threw it out, the cynics are going to say, well, you just want people to have to post bail so your folks can make money, right? But what is your serious concern as an organization that plays a vital constitutional role? Because bail falls under the Constitution. What is your concern about a policy that's like, all right, with certain offenses, because we're in agreement, like the homeless guy shouldn't even be in jail. We're in agreement of that. But, you know, let's just say that it's accurate and say that a person that does a hit and run, right, you allow them to go home. What is your concern about people like that being given a field release before they have to go to court?
Well, I think here what we're talking about is people, the officers think they should arrest and they need to arrest that then get a zero bail that under the old system would have a bail set. In other words, those people are going to get an automatic free release that wouldn't have. Now, is that everybody? No. As we learned from the Glendale press release, that's a small group of people. So the concern is that they will learn that that system exists and that they will engage in repeat behavior. And really, I think the biggest concern is going to be retail theft. You know, yesterday was retail theft, National Retail Theft Prevention Day, and you had Home Depot and all these retailers out saying, hey, you know, we need to do something about this. We need to do something about this. Well, I think this is going to go precisely contrary to what they want to do. And again, it comes down to exactly what we were talking about earlier. Do you need a street three strikes law? Do you need to give people the death penalty on shoplifting? No, but you need to make sure that if they do it, they get caught and that there's a penalty. And if we can continue that going, that's going to have an impact. And bail is part of that. When they get down to the courthouse, guess what? What is the bail for shoplifting on the 29th time? We got to go see the judge to find out. There's no automatic free release on the 30th time, the 31st time, and the 136th time, like we saw in New York. That's the big problem here. And so it's not that the whole criminal justice system is going to get flushed down the toilet and, you know, there's going to be a parade of horribles. It's going to be that there's isolated criminal activity that's going to increase at a large level on some of these things that we're really concerned about right now. you know, especially on the day after National Retail Theft Crime or National Retail Crime Prevention Theft Day.
All right. So last question, and it falls in line of your answer. So we have seen in some major cities, Atlanta, Chicago, L.A., I'm sure, other places, where you'll see a group of kids go in, bum rush a store like a Gap or something like that, go in and steal a bunch of stuff, run right back out. So under this zero bail policy, if this has happened in Los Angeles, the police officer just happens to see these group of kids and they're able to arrest them, under this policy, they'll basically do a field release with them. And what your concern is that if these kids understand, well, shoot, you know, it's like they're gonna give us release, that you think they'll get together and try to hit up as many stores as they can before they actually have to account for the crime that they were caught doing.
Yeah, and Home Depot and some of the others were pointing out that there are now roving gangs that go from state to state because they know they can do this. So they'll just go hit a state for a couple of days, move on. And the odds that they'll get prosecuted under that scenario are very limited, because even though they have surveillance tapes and stuff, they're not going to find somebody in Atlanta who shoplifts in San Francisco and only does it like three or four times in a quick strategic strike. So, you know, this is the problem. I mean, you know, this is definitely a problem. And I think this is just going to send the signal that, yeah, you're not going to get arrested. They're not going to take you in. You're not going to get jammed up in doing this. And that's going to be the problem. You know, my dad was a cop in the 70s, and he goes, you know, we never really cared what happened post-prosecution, because the point of policing is to keep the peace, that people don't want to go do these crimes because they don't want to get arrested. Now, in the 70s, that meant getting roughed up on the way to jail. But, you know, these days, you don't want to get arrested. You don't have to go through the process, because the process is uncertain. We could be in jail for a while. We don't know how long we're going to be in jail. We don't know what the judge is going to do. We're taking all that out of the equation when we say you're getting out for free, no matter how many times you do it on this list of charges. We're just doing that. And criminal suspects have told us over the years that they can figure that out. And that's what's going to happen here, I think.
All right. So, Jeffrey Clayton, I am going to give you the authority to fix the criminal justice system. And here's the keys. What's the first thing that you're going to do to address it, whether it's dealing with your bailiwick of bail, or just what would you do if you were given those keys to fix the criminal justice system? What would be the first thing on your list?
First thing on my list would be violent repeat criminals. I think we're giving them a free pass under many of these policies. My hometown of Denver, if you're disabled as a prior felon from having a firearm, the judges are giving you a $1 bail and cutting you loose. Like, that's just not acceptable. You know, we're having mass shooting up in Maine. We're talking about gun control. Well, we got criminals running on the streets, killing 12 people over a month, and we're not saying anything about that. There's no protests. There's no calls to Congress. Come on, people. We're allowing repeat violent criminals to continue to do their crimes in this country. Second thing I'm going to do, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, racial justice and racial equity, is let's survey the victims of crime and what their needs are in these communities, and let's police that way. Let's protect the communities that want the protecting in the way they want the protecting. And so I think we completely reorient policing in that respect by protecting the victims of crime in the communities from those criminals that are going after them. And the third thing is I think we got to get a handle on this organized retail theft. I do think that is a problem. You know, billions and billions and billions of dollars are being left. Maybe that's a change in message. Maybe that's people just realizing that, hey, stealing is wrong and we shouldn't do it because it costs everybody. I don't know what the message is these days to get people onto the idea that, you know, stealing isn't free. You know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. That's an old saying in economics that doesn't play on, you know, Twitter or X and TikTok and all that. But whatever it does, we need to figure it out and convince people that stealing is wrong and we need to stop it. Because it's bad for the economy. It's bad for everything. So, and then I think number four is crime prevention. You know, we know when repeat criminals get into the system, they don't get out. They go on to a life of crime. We've got to stop them from getting in the first place. And there's plenty of available opportunities to do that. We're just not putting our money where our mouth is on crime prevention.
All right, Jeff, if people want to get more information about you or the American Bail Coalition, how do they do that?
AmBailCoalition.org, or follow us on X or see us on Facebook.
All right. Well, Jeffrey Clayton, I appreciate you taking the time out and wanting to come on this podcast and talk about this issue and at least present your side of it. I think it's based on the questions I was trying to formulate, this is really a complicated thing. I was intrigued by it because of what I saw like on the documentary 13th, and you know, how it talked about that bail reform was supposed to be one of the big issues, but it kind of made it seem like it was a different form of incarceration. Like they were guiding people toward electronic bracelets as opposed to being incarcerated, but they were still in the system, right? So when I got the call to say, hey, Jeff wants to come on your show and talk about it, I said, great. You know, let's have this discussion. So hopefully we can get you back on and maybe explore this a little more if possible.
Yeah, it's a complicated topic. And as they say, you know, there's a lot of hills to die on when you're talking bail and bail reform.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Jeff Clayton. And thanks again for coming on, my man. And we'll catch y'all on the other side. All right, and we are back. So, again, I want to thank Mr. Clayton for coming on the podcast to address this issue, particularly the issue in Los Angeles County, but it's an issue that's going on nationwide. You heard me mention New Jersey and Alaska. You heard him mention New York State. Illinois is doing something, as they used to say on Monty Python, completely different. And we didn't even get a chance to get into that, right? Dealing with getting rid of bail bondsmen altogether. It's a complicated issue. And, you know, one of my earlier guests, you know, had been successful, Patrice Sultan, as far as getting the D.C. City Council to change the judicial code, the criminal code in D.C., only for the U.S. Congress and President Biden to shut that down, right? So criminal justice reform is a huge issue, not just in the African-American community, but nationally, because we've got to figure out a way to, one, make sure that, and that was the reason why I used the homeless guy situation in Atlanta, because that actually was a true story for me. You know, we got to deal with homelessness, but not through the criminal justice system. We've got to deal with mental health, but not through the criminal justice system, right? We want to strike a balance where people who deserve to go to jail go, right? You know, that they go through the process as fairly and as constitutionally as possible. But we don't want people stuck in jail just because they can't afford to get out. And, you know, we don't want people avoiding jail because they got the finances to stay out, right? And part of criminal justice reform is going to evolve from this whole Donald Trump case, right? Because a lot of people are like wondering, well, if this was Young Thug or Gunna, right, here in Atlanta, and they said about Fannie Willis what Donald Trump is saying about Fannie Willis, they'd be up under the jail, right? As a matter of fact, they're, well, Gunna's not, but Young Thug is basically
been in jail the whole time until his trial started. So people are wondering, and Young Thug is not broke. You know what I'm saying? I think his finances are more in line and honest as compared to Donald Trump's as far as what he's actually worth. But they're not broke individuals, right? But yet and still, Donald Trump is being treated a certain way as opposed to Young Thug. And the question becomes, how do we make the criminal justice system colorblind? There are some people who cynically say that'll never happen because they make the argument that the criminal justice system is not broken. It is going exactly the way it was designed to work. In which my response is, well, then we do need to break it then, right? So we can fix it. You know, we have to tear it down and reimagine it. For those who see good in the criminal justice system and figure that is just some tweaks and some adjustments, training, whatever the case may be, to make it so that it's more fair, well, let's do that, right? So with Mr. Clayton, now you've heard his side of the story, and he represents an organization that basically is the Traders Association for bail bondsmen and the insurance companies that do surety bonds, right? So naturally, they've got a certain perspective, but it's not, it shouldn't be viewed just as cynical, right, that they would do that. I think that listening to the conversation, the fact that he was willing to come on a podcast like mine, right, where, you know, the perception is, oh, well, you know, he's this liberal dude and yada, yada, yada. And they did some background where he worked for the ACLU, yada, yada. You know what I'm saying? To express their viewpoint and be comfortable in expressing their viewpoint, that speaks volumes, right? Because the only way we can really fix this problem is to have a discussion, an intelligent, calm discussion. And like I said, 30 minutes is really not enough. This is something where Patrice and Jeff and anybody else who is committed to, I mean, Tamina, right? Watson, there's an immigration piece in this. All of these folks need to be at a table somewhere and figure out how to make this thing work for everybody. And, you know, that's what should be happening in the United States Congress. Here's the segue. Instead of the crazy mess that we just went through, right, as far as just electing a Speaker of the House. But it goes back to what I talked about last podcast. It goes back to what I wrote about in the blog. When you deal with people who don't have the ambition, that don't have the philosophy, that don't have the commitment to govern, or even the ability to govern, this is why we're in the situation we're in. Man is complex, right? When I say man, I'm talking about the species of human beings, right? We're complex. And I don't know how other mammals or other reptiles or fowl handle disputes. I'm not into all that. I am fascinated with how human beings handle disputes, right? And it was some philosopher, and I'm paraphrasing, that basically said the purpose of arguing, the purpose of debate is to get it solutions, to get an answer, right? And right now we're at a point where we are debating just to score points on social media and on television and with voters to show how feisty we are or how creative we are. But we're not going toward solutions. We're just saying things to be contrarian, right? And that's not the whole point. The whole point of the body politic, the whole point of the vox populi, if you will, the people's voice, is for it to be heard and to be acted upon and to come up with solutions that society as a whole can live with. The history of America has been that we have helped out a certain group of people. And we've been trying to piecemeal other folks into that benefit. Instead of reimagining where we are and reevaluating where we are even and saying, okay, we need to We need to reform criminal justice totally, right? Pardon me for that. We need to reimagine redistricting totally. We need to reimagine government transparency totally. We need to reimagine basically everything politically, right? From a total perspective, how do we make it so that the black person in Bronzeville and the indigenous person in Oklahoma and, or, you know, Choctaw Nation even, how the Latino brother and sister in Los Angeles, how the Chinese American person can be engaged in Seattle. I mean, you know, and the white person in Kansas, the white farmer. How do we all get engaged to a point where what we do benefits everybody, right? Now, we're not all going to get everything that we want. You know, government is not Santa Claus, but there should be enough common ground where if all of those examples I put out say we want our kids to be in quality public schools, there should be a solution for that. If all these people say that we want to live in safe neighborhoods, there should be a solution for that. If all those people say, hey, we need to make sure that people are paid for the work that they are doing, that they shouldn't have to be the CEO to get the money. They should get paid for the production that benefits a CEO, right? Then we should be about doing it. And the CEO should have a voice in Congress, but they shouldn't buy and control it. You feel me? It should be equal because it's all about citizenship, right? You know, one saying we used to say when we were running for office all the time, and you had a candidate that had gazillion money and they were putting out all this stuff, and it's like, yeah, but not one of those dollar bills can vote. It's the people. And so your objective was, with whatever money you had, was to get to as many people as you could, as creatively as you could, and make sure that they voted for you or your candidate. Never mind what the other person is doing or what resources they have. You figure out to make that happen. Because if you get your message to that person, it doesn't matter how many resources they throw out there. It's basically message against message. And if you can get it to that point and you feel your candidate or you as a candidate yourself has the best message, you'll win. I look at city council race and then Sandy Springs. They say, well, you know, this sister, we'll never get anybody black on that city council. Well, that sister got in there because she had a message. And when she put her message up against her white Republican opponent, even though it's quote unquote nonpartisan, she won. Now, it wasn't like she got 90% of the vote compared to 10, but she won. She got enough people to vote for her. And if you pay attention, you would think that she's the greatest thing to ever happen to Sandy Springs. As far as just stuff, you know, different events going on, she's engaged. But she was engaged before she got elected. So this is just an extension of that. But it came down to messaging. It came down to her against a well-financed opponent and she won, right? So it should be like that for everybody. And in this day and age, you know, it needs to be an even playing field, because to me, if districts are drawn in such a way where messaging doesn't matter, then that's a problem, right? But then again, that also falls on the voters too. Because I can't believe, as much as I've been critical of people in Rome, Georgia, and Gainesville, and Centralia, Illinois, and just name a conservative city, right? Well, just, I don't know, Madison, Mississippi, right? I just can't believe that there are enough people that really think that what the Republicans are doing in Washington warrants their vote. It's all right to say, well, I agree with their position, but if they are not enacting the position that they say they're for, they're busy trying to figure out who's going to be the Speaker of the House. It took them, so basically it's taken them 10 months to get to Mike Johnson. Now they had Kevin McCarthy, but that took 15 ballots to make that happen. And then, you know, boom, after 10 months it's like, you know, so really 11 months almost. It's, you know, give or take a few days, right? We come down to Mike Johnson. Now, Mike Johnson, if you see him and you listen to his first few days of speaking, you say, oh, well, you know, maybe this is a diamond in the rough. This is the guy that, you know, will actually kind of bring some respectability back to Republicans. Well, if the Republican viewpoint is women shouldn't have any bodily autonomy at all, and that LGBTQ people should be eliminated from the face of the earth, if that's your philosophy, then Mike Johnson's your guy, right? And I don't have to agree with your politics to think that you'll be a good speaker, right? Let's not get that twisted. And if Mike Johnson, during the time that he is speaker, turns out to be a guy that can navigate the politics and work out bipartisan deals and all this stuff, cool. You know what I'm saying? If it's up to me, by this time next year, we'll be on the verge of the House being taken control by the Democrats, and the Senate will maintain Democratic control, and Joe Biden will be reelected. It was up to me, right? But since it's not up to me, it's up to the voters and their in the 435 congressional districts and the Senate seats that are up. It's usually about 30 or 40 states, right? Any give or take. It's usually about a third of the Senate that's up every 2 to 4 years. The seats are set up for 6-year terms, so you kind of got that staggering going. But for those Senate races that's up, for all the congressional seats that are up, for the gubernatorial seats that are up, right? To me, until the Republicans get back to debating policy instead of debating preference and prejudice, you know, I'm like, no. I mean, I just can't. Now, like I said, I've got Republican friends, and they envision electing people that are more in line with the traditional conservative voice, as opposed to this radical voice that has now become the mainstream to me. Good luck. I mean, you got to take them folks out in the primary. Good luck. Right? But the Republican Party that seems to be prevalent now, the Republican Party that seems to be worshiping Donald Trump, which Mike Johnson is a big MAGA guy. Again, appearances, he doesn't seem like the type, but he is. I mean, he was Donald Trump's congressional lawyer, right? During the impeachment trials. Big MAGA guy. probably should have went with him from Jump Street if it wasn't for Kevin McCarthy's lifelong desire to be speaker. Probably should have went with that guy from Jump Street and just kept it pushing for this term. Nonetheless, we are where we are. But as long as the Republican Party has that kind of mindset, you know, and that they still would entertain voting for a guy, still will give money to a guy who is eventually going to go to jail. Right? I mean, it is what it is. I don't think those folks need to be in government. I don't think they need to be supported. And I don't know what it would take to convince average Americans who are lining up that way to say, you know what? Maybe we need to look at something different. Even if you just vote for somebody different within the Republican primary, that's an improvement compared to just falling in line with this guy who was really supposed to be a tool, and now he's become the universe. I don't know how that happened. How you go from your intent was to use somebody, and now you worship the person that you were trying to use. I don't know how you get to that point, but that's where they are. So that's why I make my arguments about that. And we'll continue to until there's a shift. And then we can get into the traditional liberal conservative debates. But I want to address this one thing before I go off, and that's dealing with this guy in Maine. I don't even know what this guy's name is. They have a name of a person of interest, and they believe this is the shooter, but they refer to him as a person of interest. And there's a manhunt still going on. And, you know, they're already throwing out the mental illness thing and all this kind of stuff, which makes me wonder, well, why is this person allowed to have weapons of destruction, right? If you have an assault weapons ban, then he's got to do this with handguns as opposed to assault rifles. Nonetheless, and he really shouldn't have access to handguns, but that's another conversation. But, you know, this guy shows up to a bowling alley and kills people in the bowling alley on a night where children are at the bowling alley, right? Then he goes to a bar where people who are deaf are having a party, which almost sounds totally sick to me, because it's like, okay, so you're going to a place where these people can't even hear you coming. Most people react to the shot, even though light and bullets travel faster than sound, right? So you probably see the gun firing before you actually hear the gunshot, right? But these folks are hard of hearing. They're deaf. So you go into a bar where it's a bunch of people that have hearing issues that are deaf, and you shoot them up. And allegedly, it's like he's got hearing issues because he got a hearing aid, and all of a sudden the hearing aid started talking to him and voices. My thing is, if I got a hearing aid and the hearing aid was talking to me, that hearing aid would be in the trash and be going back to the doctor and say, hey, I don't know what kind of voodoo y'all got going on, but yeah. At that point, I would have got a health evaluation, mental health evaluation. But no, he just got the hearing aid, he got the voices, and now he's shooting people and killing them. I don't know exactly how you prevent that other than limit access to what he has. And then you had one congressman say, yeah, I'm for the ban now because this happened in my district. And then you got the senator from the same state saying, well, I'm not for the assault weapons ban this time. I'm more for, like, eliminating the magazines. If you're going to eliminate the bullets, eliminate the gun. How about do them both? Eliminate the gun, eliminate the bullets. The Second Amendment is still in effect because you can get a handgun and you can get a rifle, you know, to go hunting. Like deer and ducks and beavers instead of people. Because that's what assault rifles are for people. For armies to take out other armies. That's what they're designed for. In the fastest way possible. They're not designed for protection of a home. And they shouldn't be available for people to cause destruction in bars and bowling alleys and movie theaters and Walmart shopping centers and Dollar General stores or college campuses or parades. Concerts. That's not what those weapons are designed to do, and they shouldn't be accessible to people that want to do harm in those kind of venues. And how that infringes on the Second Amendment, I don't know. Because if I've got a handgun and the guy's got an assault rifle, maybe I'll get a shot off. But I won't live to tell about it. Right? It would seem to me that if you want the playing field to be even, then even it. If you're for law enforcement, even the playing field. Because most law enforcement officers don't carry assault rifles. They have handguns. Maybe they have a tactical shotgun. So you want your police officer to stroll up on a situation where a guy's got an assault rifle. Right? And that's what officers are trained to do, by the way. When they have the active shooter situation, they've got to go in and they've got to address the threat. Now, maybe a SWAT team can get there in time, but most of the time it's a regular police officer. Like what happened in Nashville when they were able to catch the shooter by surprise and take them out. A lot of times the shooter takes themselves out. So the officers don't have to have that confrontation. And a lot of times when officers do have that confrontation, the officers are wounded if they survive. Because that person has an assault weapon. I mean, that's reality, man. And the reason that we're still having this debate is insane. And that's why I say that these elections are important, because it's like the extreme positions can be allowed to talk, but at some point the rational people have to take whatever's good from both extreme sides and come up with a solution. Right? We don't want to infringe upon anybody's rights, but we want to preserve the most important right, and it's that people need to live and to live abundantly. If there's something from the Bible that you need to be quoting, Mike Johnson, is that God intended us to live abundantly. And we can't live abundantly in a society where people have access to weapons of mass destruction. We can't live in a society where it's okay to discriminate against people because of what they look like or who they love or whatever. You can't live abundantly if a CEO of a corporation is making 1,000 times more than the person that works for them. You can't. So we've got to get to a mindset, ladies and gentlemen, where all of this stuff needs to be debated and debated intelligently towards gaining a solution so that we can live abundantly in the United States of America. Where we could literally live up to the preamble of the U.S. Constitution. That's where we need to be. And if the persons that are running for positions in office are not pushing towards solutions, all they are is pushing rhetoric, they are not the persons that need to be in government, period. And I make the argument that is more prevalent on the right than it is on the left. Are there extremists on the left? Yes. And if you watch how people on the left in left-leaning districts vote, very rarely do the radical left get elected. It's more the pragmatic left that gets in. Just look at the numbers. Just look at the Democrats that are in Congress now as opposed to the Republicans that are in Congress now. And that tells you how Democrats view government as opposed to Republicans view government. To me, it seems that Republican voters hate government and Democrats want government to work. They're not necessarily enamored with it, but they believe government can help if you put the right people in position. And I think if the Republican voters took the same attitude as Democratic voters, then we can get some stuff done. Will we agree with everything? Probably not, but at least we can guarantee there was an intelligent debate. That's just my two cents on it, guys. Thank y'all for listening to the podcast. Keep sending the feedback in. And we're going to keep bringing out quality podcasts and keep these issues going. And again, whatever we don't cover on the podcast, probably going to cover it on Patreon. So make sure you subscribe to patreon.com/A Moment with Eric Fleming. Until next time.